coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
I started my residency the year that Prozac came out. You know, so it was a paradigm shift in psychiatry then, because there were just like the old school tricyclics or go to ECT or something like that. Prozac came out and it was like, wow, you can take this medication and deal with, you know, alienation and sadness and self-harm feelings with a low side effect profile. Prozac was like a revolution then. And it was remarkable. It was easy. Here, take this SSRI. And we won't just have psychiatrists doing it who do psychotherapy, hopefully. We will just medicate, right? And everyone can take it and it'll be easy. So I'm hoping there was a good intention there. But somewhere along the line, everything got out of whack and it became the answer. And we forgot about, like, you have a choice of what to eat for breakfast. You have a choice of moving. You have a choice to feel, raise your feelings to a different feeling. It was just like, okay, the Prozac's going to take care of it. The Zoloft's going to take care of it. Here in psychedelic medicine, it's happening again. Like it's a revolution again with the molecule, you know, that can do something. But again, it's just the beginning with the molecule, right? It's just the beginning of real transformation.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts, presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. This is your host, Eamon Armstrong. The psychedelic renaissance is well underway. But 30 years ago, there was another revolution in mental health, the introduction of Prozac, the very first SSRI. Today's guest, Dr. Priya Parmar, started her residency at that time, but today she is ending her relationship with traditional psychiatry. Since 2017, she has been using ketamine in her practice, which she feels is a potent frontline treatment for mental health disorders, with the caveat of the importance of integration. On the show, Priya and I share a long preamble about the state of the American healthcare system, and we talk about the crisis in confidence in Western medical authority. Priya explains why she started using ketamine and her particular protocol with the medicine. We discuss set and setting, group versus individual sessions, recreational use of ketamine, as well as tolerance and dependency. Finally, Priya shares her passion for supporting patients in getting off of the antidepressants that were once heralded as a miraculous cure. Priya is a board-certified psychiatrist in Los Angeles, California. After almost 20 years in a solo practice in San Francisco, she is now the CEO of State of Mind Wellness Center, where she offers ketamine-assisted therapy based on the social theory of primates. And now, here is Priya Parmar.
Hi, nice to meet you. Nice to see you. Hello.
Hi, Eamon. Good morning.
Good morning. And you know how to pronounce my name, which is lovely. I usually have to let people know beforehand that it's Eamon, but I'm glad that you already know it. You pronounced it correctly.
I love that name.
Really?
Yeah. I've known Eamons before. Usually people who are pretty wise and open.
Oh, wow. Well, I will try to live up to that in our conversation today.
What does it mean?
So Eamon is the Gaelic version of the English name Edmund. So they're the same name, but it's the Irish version. And it means rich protector. And when I was younger, I thought that meant rich as in money, like a king. But the way that I interpret my name is in service of the protection of the richness of life. That's how I live my name, is protecting the richness of life itself. That is my job. So.
Ooh, protecting the richness of life. We need that.
Thank you. What does Priya mean?
So there is a saying in the North Indian part of the world where the ancestors from my background are, that you become your name.
I love that.
Priya means beloved.
Oh.
So it's pretty simple. I just like to go back to that sometimes when I meet someone, like their name. just the basic, where does it come from? What are its origins? There's so much energy transmitted and what you're called every day. Protector of riches, man, you know?
Priya, it seems to me like you have a pretty great bedside manner. Considering the way that you are just now meeting me, a podcaster, connecting with my name and offering the beloved your name as well. It strikes me as you probably put your clients at ease.
I hope so. When someone comes to you in a state of despair, I think it's such a place where it's important to feel like you can connect. And that's not always honored, but it's just in that moment of meeting someone, so much can happen. So much can occur in that. To be seen, right? You know, not just to be checked off a list, like crossed off, like to be seen.
Well, it seems that our mental health crisis is so much one that has to do with connection. Are you familiar with Jonah Hari's work, the book Lost Connections?
Lost Connections.
When we think about mental health, I read that book and I have had my own relationship to depression and anxiety in my life. And the idea of a disconnection from other, a disconnection from nature, a disconnection from purpose, a disconnection above all from one's own self, from one's body. It seems that's really a key component to this kind of like ballooning global mental health crisis, at least in my non-professional opinion.
100%, Eamon. Disconnection. And one of the things that strikes me whenever I meet with someone, let's just say post-COVID, or someone I've worked with pre-COVID, post-COVID meetings, there's this numbness. There's this disconnection and numbness, and it's pervasive. So whatever people were doing to protect themselves from the threats, that you've got the fight, flight, freeze. But I think there's also this numbness in America that's tragic. And there's the part where I'm hoping that the changes in psychiatry and mental health can help crack the numbness open, not perpetuate numbness through misadministration of medications or enabling types of psychotherapy, you know, like just perpetuate numbness and your relationship to a cycle that isn't working. Something that helps us go more internally and access that part of our unconscious, that part of our soul that's yearning to be seen and heard and understood. It doesn't work when you're numb. I mean, you may be functional, right? Like drive your car, get your coffee at the drive-through and perpetuate some sort of system, but it's at a great expense to a person's personal gift and knowing of their expression here in America, on earth, in their family, at work even. It's been a challenge lately. People will come in and say, I just need something to get me through. Give me a little pick-me-up. Give me a little something so I don't feel this so much. And it's been a challenge to say, that's not where I'm going to be of value to you. If you want to explore what is meaning and what this crisis can mean and how we can break through, I can help you that way. And yeah, we can use the technology of medications. We can use the technology of ketamine to help you to break through, but not to perpetuate this numbness.
Well, I mean, I think we have this sort of industrial revolution format of getting things done and perpetuating cycles of, you know, you have a family unit that perpetuates labor, that we have a sort of like format of getting things done and being productive that's blown into this kind of like late stage capitalist American prosperity thing. But so many people are so miserable and so disconnected. And just as you've just described, this sort of give me something that allows me to keep doing the thing I'm doing, allows me to keep making money. But for what purpose? Why are we living if we're just trying to numb ourselves out to perpetuate these cycles?
So those are big questions. The huge medical industrial complex that we're living in America is very different than the ones in Germany or England, where we aren't in such anxiety about our healthcare. Like, the system itself is really challenging people, that they don't necessarily feel safe. So I am eager to work on ways to get more access for everybody for mental health care, and even just basic maternal health care and pediatric health care. I mean, in mental health care, what has happened is there have been created a bunch of codes. Like, this is the code for major depression. This is the code for depression and anxiety. This is the code for OCD. This is the code for PTSD. And it's a really linear system. So you'll get this code, depression with anxiety, 296.4. And that'll follow you the rest of your life, and you'll get your meds. You'll be plugged into the system and you'll be known as that. And truly, people don't work like that. I mean, there are gradations of depression. There are levels of depression. There are different types. There are different biological types. So what we're coding for in our system, it's just shorthand and it's not even accurate. So I don't know how things will change to reflect more accurately the growth and evolution of a human mind under stress or in a state of crisis. So when you have a code, then according to different insurance plans, you are allowed to prescribe certain medications that will be paid for. So who makes those decisions? I mean, I like to think it's done under great care, but it isn't always. It's just who has the dollars, who has the type of patent to sway lobbies to prescribe this type of medication for this diagnostic code. I don't think it's working anymore. You know, you may get the basics covered, but you're not going to get lifted in any way out of a rut. You may be able to get out of bed, and that's good, but there's more going on. And I think that's where the revolution in healthcare is at. And how do we meet in this zone? So it can be coded appropriately and paid for by a system? Or do we just need to rework the system?
Well, I think we all need to work on reworking the system. Because as you pointed out, we have the pharmaceutical companies with their incentives, their relationship to universities with those incentives, the insurance companies with their incentives, and the entire sort of organism is feeding its own parts equally, but it's not in service of the patient primarily. It's in service of the incentives that are embedded in these large companies with their profit motives and their shareholders. It's the problem of late stage capitalism writ large, but when you have it in a healthcare system like this, with these different pieces, these large organizations working in concert to maximize profit versus to maximize healing and innovative healing, yeah, we're just heading in entirely the wrong direction, at least in my humble opinion.
It's not helping anything. It's just maybe there's fear around changing the system. I mean, even the people who work in the insurance companies are quite cynical and depressed about the work they do, but that doesn't stop them from changing something. What will it take for us to wake up and say, we really need to be here for people? We really need to be here for each other. How's that? Not just people, for each other.
Well, and that's part of what we're going to attempt to accomplish today on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. And we're going to talk about what you've learned and how other practitioners can look at the experience that you've had so that we can all make change and we can all insist on change in a kind of unified voice. So that is part of the goal of our conversation today. So with that preamble and with our kind of moment of laying the foundation, Priya, I would love to invite you and welcome you to today's episode of the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. So welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Eamon. I appreciate that. Thank you. It's really good to be here.
So you have been a psychiatrist. Do you consider yourself at this moment, do you consider yourself a psychiatrist, or how do you refer to yourself as a medical professional?
I'm working on that right now currently, but at present it's psychiatrist. I've had other awakenings, psychiatrist, healer, occultist, you know, lover, appreciator, artist, you know. I think psychiatrist has become a limiting label. But I have studied psychiatry and I've practiced it for 25 years along with other things.
Wow. Okay. So I love that as a starting place. So maybe that'll be something that comes out of our conversation today too, is just sort of different ways that we can think of the healers in our culture. Because there does seem to be, there's a sort of a hierarchy based on how much time you've put into medical school and residencies. And there's this hierarchy where, at least when I was younger and I was going through my issues with mental health, it was like, well, the psychiatrist is the one that knows the most. And you pay the most for that person. That was how I understood it when I was younger. And the psychiatrist has access to these magical pills that purport to turn you back to a normal person. So they're the ones that are going to help you the most. And then as my journey has continued and I've tried alternative therapies and medicines and different sorts of things, I'm like, oh, okay, well, the psychiatric profession itself does have its limitations and has certain antiquated structures to it. I imagine that you, based on the conversation so far, you might agree with that.
Yeah. Wholeheartedly, Eamon. I can say that at the age of 5, I knew I was going to be a psychiatrist. I watched a show on the brain with my father that just obsessed me. I was consumed with the concept that one could localize where dreams are, where relationships occur, you know, like, oh, it's the brain. That's it. So as I've, like, how many years later, I'm like, well, it's kind of non-localized and it's kind of shared between so many people, but that's been a long journey. The initial impulse to go into psychiatry, I think at its purest, is to help people to eliminate suffering and eliminate suffering in what you see people on the street, in the family, and also like a desire to problem solve. So if we can localize it to the brain, then we can really do something. And maybe that's rooted in, what is it, rescue fantasies. I think it's rooted in a lot of rescue fantasies. And in my experience, just the process of being with people medically was a great honor for me to go to medical school, to learn this knowledge. Recently, I was in Berlin in a hall, a Virchow hall, and he was a neurologist who discovered stains for certain neurons. And I was like, oh my God, I'm like, it's part of the passage of information. And I feel that that information is honorable and deep. However, as we've got this medical industrial complex going on, I don't think that spark of humanitarianism or of even romanticism about healing people is sustained, because it costs so much to go to medical school. And post-medical school, corporations, not all corporations are bad, but corporations know that you got a lot of debt. So here, come and work in our system, see 20 to 30 people a day, you'll get your debts cleared. And based out of fear, you know, it's easy to just sign up with a factory, a mental health factory, you know, where you lose the quality. So I think that's what's happening now a lot with medicine. It's becoming just more of those assembly lines.
Well, you know, and it's tricky because we have this crisis of authority in terms of the Western medical establishment. So if you look at something like the opioid crisis, it completely saps trust in Western medicine as an institutional sort of like authority, right? But then concurrently, there's all sorts of alternative medical options that are, frankly, a lot of fringe science and a lot of woo-woo. There's a lot of kind of BS there. And so I think many of us are left in this place where, okay, we were told we'd take Prozac and we'd be fine. Uh-huh. For many of us, I think for most of the folks I've talked to, that did not work out. And then we have, alongside that, a whole gradient of things that seem like they would never work, and some things like acupuncture, which, like, I don't understand why it works, but it seems like it does, mm-hmm. all the way to now we're talking about somatic healing and healing the body, and the body keeps the score, trauma in the body, how that affects things. I mean, it can be a dizzying array of potential modes of healing without, it seems in this moment, the feeling that there's an authority that really understands how healing, particularly of the mind and mental health, actually even works at this moment. For you, as someone who's been in the psychiatric profession for over 20 years, how do you feel about medical authority in terms of these traditional Western modes of healing, or maybe not traditional, but these popular Western modes of healing versus these alternative therapies, up to and including psychedelics?
Oh boy, this is a great question. As primates, as social primates, we are always going to need to relate to another person. That's how we learn. Unless we're on the spectrum, and that's different. We're going to learn that way. And then just out of being human mammal, we're going to need hierarchies. We definitely need authority. And there's a way in which, I'm going to get passionate now, the patriarchy has stolen inner authority. Sometime around the 1500s, something really changed and people were burned and knowledge went underground about healing and different plants and different ways of being in the world and knowing ourselves. So authority, and in America, like, medical authority is so often equated with the systems of patriarchy. You know, like, I've worked so hard, I've put in all of this, so you will obey me. Versus the cultivation of the inner scaffolding where you feel like an authority. You have the confidence, or people relate to you naturally from that place. Can you help me? And then there is trust. It's not this fake false self, like, I've got to trust you because everybody says you're a psychiatrist. I don't know how you market that. Okay, so here we are again in Western medicine. I don't know how you commercialize that. So then you've got all of the other types of healing. Again, I'll refer back to rescue fantasies. In the healing traditions, whether it's medicine or crystal mystic healing, astrology, energy work, that part of us that needs to rescue needs to be examined. So I think a healer, an energy healer who energy heals because it is of them, they feel it, they move it, not because they need to help you or save you, but this is who they are and what they do, and they just do it so well. I think I would trust that person more than someone who says, I promise you this, I'm going to change your life and you've got to listen to me 100%. I encourage people to question their healers. Who are you? What is your relationship to me? What do you do to keep yourself on track? And then again, there's so much that corrupts the system of, for example, like the star system on Yelp or reviews. You know, you're going to go to this doctor or this healer because of this. There's so much in our personal interactions that can just make it really difficult to find someone authentic. So I embrace all different traditions, but I think when it comes from a place of integrity, honesty, and depth versus exterior authority, you can feel if someone has integrity and it comes through in how they live their life.
Well, and we're lucky because today we have such a person to speak to about these matters and someone who has spent a long time investigating them. So I'm interested in what you think.
Okay.
In terms of healing specifically around mental illness. I understand that a big part of your experience as a healer is to help people understand theories of brain chemistry and other theories about how humans create a shared existence in reality. So part of your work is actually to teach people these different ways of thinking about their own minds and thinking about their own healing and health. I was just referring a moment ago to a kind of crisis of confidence in the medical establishment. And what you've just shared with me is that if you can feel someone's integrity, then you can trust where they're coming from and you can see how it relates to your own experience. In your practice, it seems that you spend a lot of time creating that trust and giving people a deeper understanding about how their minds work. And I was wondering if maybe we could do some of that in this conversation today.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so it's metacognition. How do I think about how I think? It takes it out of just reactivity. So over time, it's like this, wow, I actually can think about what made me sad, or I can link this pain in my stomach to anger, you know, that I've been afraid to express because anger, you know, good women don't get angry, but, you know, you get all kinds of other illnesses in your body, but you don't get angry. So education about emotions and a safe place and a safe relationship to break down those feelings that are so suppressed. It's amazing. And I don't even think it's suppressed over like a lifetime. I think this is intergenerational stuff, you know, coming from a land of patriarchy and oppression of women, South Asian women. Wow. There's a lot of that coming out. So, but the thing is, Eamon, people grow at their own rates, right? Mm-hmm. To give people time. And that's something that I find conflicting with insurance is if you don't prescribe a medication within, you know, two sessions, then you will not be, the insurance will not pay you for seeing patients, which I'm not sure many people understand. So it's difficult, you know, to really access that part. So going to alternative healers, one will have more time to do that, and it will be embraced more in the culture versus traditional psychiatry.
So you started working with ketamine in 2017, and you've expressed that this has totally revolutionized your practice. So we have a couple threads in the conversation, the issues with insurance, the way that people understand their own healing. We have a couple of kind of threads that I think will continue as we have this conversation. I'm curious how, first of all, how you've decided to bring ketamine into your practice. How did you learn about ketamine as a healing modality? And what made you even decide that this was something you wanted to experiment with in terms of working with your patients?
I've always been fascinated by non-ordinary states of consciousness. So this was a way to officialize, so to speak, non-ordinary states of consciousness and the information that can be accessed in a person's unconscious when they're in a trance state, in a dissociative state, in a psychedelic state. So when I saw that there was an ability to do this with people, I was very excited and I wanted to learn as much as possible. But I also wanted to do it in a way that wasn't telling a person how to be or following an algorithm for health or mental health or a checklist. I thought it was a way to help people liberate more of their soul intention versus you know, just saying, okay, you're ready to go back to work. I mean, yeah, work will happen, but in a whole different relationship to it, one potentially can access the fact that there's choice. How do I meet this moment? How do I meet this day? How do I continue with my day-to-day life? That's one of the things I've noticed with work with ketamine and non-ordinary states of consciousness, because meditators will start going to this place too. And I've meditated, I got my first mantra when I was 5. So I've been very involved in that type of experience and choice and learning what I bring and different frequencies and different vibrations associated with different emotional states. And how that affects what we attract to bring into our life. So that was something amazing with ketamine. It could condense about like 5 years of work, talking, getting into that place. And it comes up quite abruptly. I mean, it can take a few sessions, but it's presented right there. And I think that's so new. And it's like lightning in a bottle. And it's so beautiful, and it's edgy too. How you approach it, how you touch it, how you respect it.
Considering that it is edgy, what is your ketamine protocol? I know you were just saying that there's not like an algorithm for how you use it, but when you're working with clients, do you have a specific process by which you use ketamine in your work? Are you doing a session of talk therapy with a patient? Can you break down how you're actually using ketamine in your practice?
Well, it would depend upon how naive a person is to non-ordinary states of consciousness. First, we take a thorough history about their experience with different substances, different molecules, medications, mental health. Then, based upon a person's comfort level with trance states, we can customize a dose. Generally, I mean, and also they have to be cardiac cleared, no history of head trauma, like loss, recent head trauma that hasn't been healed, or active psychosis. I use intranasal. I also use lozenges. People who are more anxious prefer the control with the intranasal. And so the first time we go to 50 to 100 milligrams of intranasal within 2 hours, dosed within a space of 5 to 10 minutes, and then let the person be and see what's emerging for them. And then very rarely do we go to those super high places where people cannot communicate. People actually like to stay at a certain level where they're semi-conscious and accessing stuff that, you know, it's almost like a dream state. You know, what images, body feelings, memories that people didn't even know they had emerge. So it's a very individual dosage schedule, and we monitor blood pressure and heart rate, and it's so well tolerated. It's amazing. Lozenge is different because I think people have to have a lot of trust that I'm taking this substance and it will affect my mind. But anywhere from 50 milligram lozenge to 200 during a session.
This is something that's interesting to me, is that ketamine is also a recreational substance. And there are many people who have used it or do use it recreationally. And I'm curious, do you have clients or patients who come in who have a recreational history with ketamine? And if so, how does that affect you as a practitioner potentially working with them? Do you not work with people who've had an experience? Is there an issue with tolerance if people have used it a lot in a recreational setting? Perhaps it's not as effective. Considering it is such a common recreational substance as well, how does that influence your practice?
Most of the people, young people, at least I've seen in LA, have had experience with ketamine. It informs me, how have you used it? Why have you used it? It's not a deal breaker by any means. I have not worked with anyone who was addicted to or developed symptoms to ketamine, like that they were chronic ketamine users. I think that would be more common in Europe. So I would actually ask some of the doctors there. They just opened a clinic in Berlin, but they do urine toxes. It is not in your best interest to have used a substance, even cannabis, 48 hours prior to your ketamine journey. It's just not in your best interest. As far as addiction, I've never seen anyone become addicted. Tolerance, a few people become tolerant, but not in ways that are alarming where you have to like triple the dose. I typically space out the sessions then and just, you know, say, let's take the material from a session 2 or 3 months ago. But if the tolerance is growing in any concerning way, but I have not seen people crave this drug, ask for this drug out of session, or get in any trouble in their personal lives secondary to starting ketamine assisted therapy.
So ketamine is not a classical psychedelic. It is a dissociative anesthetic. And it's been tested a lot because it's been an anesthetic since the 70s. It's on the World Health Organization's list of essential medicines. It's used in pediatric surgery, battlefield medicine. It's a remarkably non-toxic and safe experience that has been tested over many, 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 many cases. But it's not a traditional psychedelic. And we started this conversation by talking about numbness and a crisis in numbness, and that depression is itself kind of a flattening experience. And the SSRIs seem to, certainly in my experience taking them and others I've spoken to, seem to also kind of flatten, seem to kind of narrow the width of experience. Ketamine, you've said, helps sort of with this numbness. But I'm curious, because if it is an anesthetic, if it is dissociative, how does that work that it is actually expanding experience versus dissociating us, numbing us? Can you explain how that works in your experience?
How does that work? Yes, it's a great question. So thinking about it like as a brain, in a brain, there is a network called the default mode network, okay? Inner critic, where your mind goes to when you're not attending to something like, oh, Priya, you should have done that. You could have done that. Default mode network. That is suspended with the doses of ketamine that we use here. We do not use the K-hole doses where you completely dissociate from body and time and space. We loosen up the default mode network. And so when you release that feelings that have been repressed, you know, use the old psychoanalytic terms, repressed feelings in the body, in the mind, just emerge. People will actually name the feeling that they're having. Like, I've been sad. I feel like I need to be sad to stay alive. All right. That's a big thing. So then that will come up in a dissociated state that typically would take months to put in words. So it comes in the feeling, and then there's crying associated with it. And then like, just let it go, shake it off, because your default mode network would say, oh, this isn't socially appropriate. This is weird. I don't want to do this. But it's so remarkable that with that loosened, what people allow themselves or what is allowed to come forth. And I know there are people who actually do use the dissociative state where they give a dose intravenously, usually to get to that place where you're just listening to music and feeling the universe or whatever. But I don't do that here. That is a theory where you reboot your whole neural networks. And there's a downward cascade of how the NMDA receptors affect different default mode mechanisms, but you just reboot. I actually work on the social theory of primates. I really think we need other people to metabolize things that we're feeling and learning.
It's very interesting. I hadn't actually heard it separated that way, that this really high dose is actually almost like a brain reset versus a kind of dampening of the default mode network that allows relational healing to occur. That's the distinction that you're making here?
Yes. That's how I see it.
That's really interesting. I definitely agree that we are harmed in relationships and we heal in relationships. You know, I'm a big fan of attachment theory as a big part of what causes a lot of suffering for humans. Early childhood adverse experiences with caregivers that then create issues of trust and connection later on that can kind of self-perpetuate. This idea that ketamine can be a relational tool in the way you've just described is really interesting. And in my experience with ketamine, there's also a sense that there's the dampening of the default mode network, I think is really a helpful way of getting you closer to things that you're afraid of talking about or afraid of touching. There's also just the general kind of like floaty, safe feeling that ketamine seems to impart. And I don't know if that's about the default mode network or not, but when I've had experiences of healing with ketamine, I feel like I can actually touch things in my being, in my physical body, in my psyche. I can go to places that I'm otherwise afraid to go because I almost feel like I'm in kind of a protective, floaty ketamine cloud. I don't know what the scientific term for it is. To me, that seems a little bit different than necessarily a dampening of the default mode network, but maybe it is the same thing. But that's part of the healing for me that I've experienced.
Has that been in a certain type of set or setting? I think there's, you get the setting can really incur that voluptuousness and that just loving, warm embrace feeling. There are some places where you go to an anonymous kind of clinical room, like a semi-ER, and I don't think that's going to create that kind of feeling as much as a curated environment, more warm.
Well, so for you as a practitioner, what kind of a setting are you creating for your patients? Are you seeing patients in an office setting? Is there certain ways that you're making that environment cozy or more conducive to that kind of surrender we're discussing?
You know, since I started doing the ketamine treatment, how much it's opened my life as a healer to like trust in the universe. So I started a garden. So it's really interesting when I have a new patient I'm doing ketamine work with, or, you know, deep work with, you know, I'll plant a plant or I'll notice a plant in the garden growing a certain way and I'll bring in cuttings to the session. Sometimes I'll tell the person, sometimes I won't, but I'll bring that in, you know, just sort of like in honor and service of their process, just in the natural world, bringing it in. But I do it in an office with kind of effects like that, touches like that. There's a lot of art. You can lie down. You know, I have a zero gravity chair if you want to just totally recline back. And music. I actually spend time honoring that a person's musical background. Some people are really Ravi Shankar. Some people are more acid jazz. Some people are more like Thievery Corporation, or music is so important. It's so evocative. I do lights. We have these beautiful lighting effects.
And so for you in the course of your experience, and if you feel comfortable answering this, have you had your own experience as a patient with ketamine? Have you experienced the experiences that your patients then are feeling? And if so, and again, if you feel comfortable relating this, if so, how has that influenced you as a practitioner?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I have. And Eamon, I mean, it was very important for me to go through that and to know the vulnerability involved in this sort of process. I mean, for me, it was such an expansion. It was such an expansion. And I really honor that potential for some. I mean, everyone will have their own experience, but mine was a very positive expansion. And I think knowing that really helps me in the arena. I also, in choosing the right set and setting and person to do this with, I went through a lot. When you're talking about who do you choose to work in the set, a medical professional, like person non in the field, but it helped me go through like my own process of learning to trust and what has integrity to me. And I also have real sensitivity after going through it for the individual process one-on-one with a person versus a group experience. So yeah, I've done both.
Yeah, individual versus group experience. I'm guessing that you're typically doing a one-on-one experience as a healer yourself. Have you conducted group ketamine experiences? Do you feel that there's a particular efficacy to that environment versus another? I'm curious about that distinction in your eyes.
For a group healing, I would use more of a global approach, for chakra healing, different mantras played during the session just to release and clear versus more of an individual. It's just much more universal, which is good too, but it's just not as in there for the person.
One of the skill sets that you have as a psychiatrist is an understanding of SSRIs and similar medications. Therefore, you have an ability to support patients in going off of these medications. I think this is an interesting component to psychedelic healing. With ketamine, you can be on SSRIs, but if you're going to be taking something like ayahuasca, you absolutely cannot. And there is the serotonin interaction with certain molecules. You can do ketamine while you're on an antidepressant, but a lot of times people are wanting to get off of these antidepressants because they have major side effects. They may not be working anymore. But at the same time, whilst people are going off of these meds, they may be experiencing a heightened sensations that are really difficult to manage and difficult to handle. My mother is currently going off of Prozac that she's been on for 30 years, and she's interested in psychedelic medicine. And she's related. She's like, I don't think they work at all. And yet now that I'm going off of them, I'm feeling these intense emotions and mood swings that are really hard for me. So for you as a practitioner, how are you helping these patients go off of their medications? And what should other practitioners who may not have as deep an experience in the kind of psychiatric mode as you have, how might they think about supporting patients and going off of antidepressant medication?
Integration, right? Just really integration work is so important. It used to sound cheesy to me, Eamon, journal, write down those feelings, journal, get it out. We have feelings for a reason. And then if we're so overwhelmed by the flood of our emotions, take a step back with someone who you trust and say, I have a lot of shame, or I have a lot of anger, anxiety about all these feelings I have. What are they about? Talk to someone who understands emotional regulation and emotional processing. Exercise, move your body, move through it. It really works. And also, if there really destructive feelings come out, there's an art to distraction, coping mechanisms like warm water baths, like ice on the back of your neck, helping people learn to get through to the next phase of the emotion, helping people bridge that so they're just not flooded. And I would go slow when someone comes in like with 10 years, 2 mg of Prozac every week or something, like compound it so it's slowly, because it took a while for your thermostat to get stuck right here. It's going to get a little wobbly, and just go slowly and with a lot of support.
And so this brings me to what I think is a foundational paradigm shift between psychiatric medication, SSRIs, et cetera, where you're prescribed something and encouraged to go along with your daily life, perhaps with some talk therapy, versus psychedelic medicine as it's emerging, which has this really beautiful and robust integration process that goes along with it and is increasingly being spoken of within healing circles. So when someone takes a psychedelic someone has a psychedelic experience and it's very powerful, there isn't this idea of, okay, now you're healed because you had that experience. In fact, that experience is a catalyst. And then the healing is like, okay, what are the ways that you want to change your life? To me, that's a paradigmatic shift from the idea of prescribe an SSRI. Do you feel that way in your relationship to psychiatry?
100%. It's brilliant. I love it. We have to reinforce this. So I finished my residency, or I started my in the year that Prozac came out. So it was a paradigm shift in psychiatry then. because there were just like the old school tricyclics or go to ECT or something like that. Prozac came out and it was like, wow, you can take this medication and deal with, you know, alienation and sadness and self-harm feelings with a low side effect profile. Prozac was like a revolution then. And it was remarkable. It was easy. Here, take this SSRI. And we won't just have psychiatrists doing it who do psychotherapy, hopefully. We will just medicate, right? And everyone can take it and it'll be easy. So I'm hoping there was a good intention there. But somewhere along the line, everything got out of whack and it became the answer. And we forgot about, like, you have a choice of what to eat for breakfast. You have a choice of moving. You have a choice to raise your feelings to a different feeling. It was just like, okay, the Prozac's going to take care of it. The Zoloft's going to take care of it. Here in psychedelic medicine, it's happening again. Like, it's a revolution again with the molecule that can do something. But again, it's just the beginning with the molecule, right? It's just the beginning of real transformation.
Have you looked much into functional medicine? I've been working with a functional medicine doctor, looking at my genes, looking at my gut health, looking at my diet. This functional medicine approach seems like it might also dovetail really well with psychedelic medicine. Have you looked into that at all? Has that been on your radar?
Yeah. So genetic testing is very important, I think, before starting a medication here in a clinic or anything. But the gut-brain connection is so critical, healing one's microbiome. I don't do specific tests in here, but I do refer people to get their gut microbiome checked out and to heal it as much as possible with supplements. We have these neurons in our guts that produce serotonin. So much of our mood regulation occurs in our gut. So functional medicine would go hand in hand. Oh boy. And actually, even for someone who's going off of SSRIs, it's really important that we look at the diet component and supplementation.
Yeah, it's so amazing how these pieces are all coming together. And it seems like it's all about the holistic approach. It's all about kind of looking at everything, where a psychedelic, ketamine treatment, an ayahuasca ceremony, that can be a galvanizing force that can make a big shift in awareness and in consciousness and in the ability to make change. But then you're really looking at everything. And the final piece, you know, we're looking at the gut, we're looking at the health, but the final piece is looking at society itself. And I think that this is the key here, where if the psychedelic renaissance is actually going to become a psychedelic revolution, it has to change society as well. And we talked about this in the beginning of our conversation about mental health through the medical industrial complex, these issues with pharmacies and insurance companies and how they're all sort of working with each other. There's also these institutions that prey on sickness, the troubled teen industry of which I was.
Oh my goodness. So troubled teen industry. It's just, I get passionate about that. The damage that's been created from that. So often teenagers come in or parents send their teen to the office, like, fix them. And they're so often a scapegoat for so many feelings that are not able to be expressed in the family. And often they're like intergenerational magnifiers of something that was going on, like in the old country. And here it's out. And then we suppress, we shame in order to fit a certain set of rules. It hurts me, you know. So how to give a young person the time and the understanding to figure out what they like, first of all, and give them hope. So often we just, you like that? You can't do that. Forget about that. And then you give them medications to pull them away from more of their natural inclinations. It takes time to listen to someone. And so often, for the teen industry, we need to look at parents. And many times, I mean, the parents are footing the bill and they don't have time to look at their issues, you know, fix them. So it really starts with us. Healing starts with us. And, you know, I can't go out into the room, the waiting room, and say, it's all them. They're all crazy. I mean, I have to look at myself and say, how am I relating to the pain and suffering in the world? How can I raise this in some way in myself, first of all? So with a troubled teen, giving a troubled teen some indicator that you can hear them is, you know, is going to go a long way. It may not be expressed, oh, I think this is so cool, but it's just going to be felt. So again, not being numb is really helpful when working with people.
So earlier in the conversation, we were speaking about how Prozac emerged early in your career. Prozac emerged as this sort of miraculous thing where it's like, okay, we finally have this thing. There's a fear that perhaps psychedelic medicine is having a similar moment of, oh my God, now we have this thing and it's psychedelic medicine. But as is so often the case, we won't really know how well a lot of these things are working until society has ingested them writ large and we've had a number of years to see what kinds of knock-on or corollary effects there might be. When you look at psychedelic medicine, particularly ketamine that you're using in your practice, do you see any sort of like red flags for issues that might be happening, issues perhaps of dependency or even societal issues in the onboarding of these medicines? Should we be worried about the new wonder drugs that are psychedelics in the context of therapy, much as we should have when we were first looking at Prozac?
I think the integration piece will hopefully get really reinforced secondary to what didn't happen with SSRIs. With psychedelic medicine, we're changing culture and it's going to take time. We're changing the human story. It's going to take a lot of time, a lot of experimentation. I'm working in LA where there's a ketamine clinic on any corner you could go to, right? And it's, in my mind, it's been exploited for its cash potential. It really has been. And it's the Wild West here. There are some really ethical, amazing practitioners, but I think there have been a lot of negative consequences from non-specialized people working with ketamine, just saying reboot. And then people aren't ready to reboot and they have crises lasting for a long time. You've got that. In LA, it's like the Wild West. And then I was in Berlin and they just opened their first clinic in Berlin and they're getting EKGs and I think they're even getting CAT scans prior to doing a ketamine treatment. And they're very medicalized and very tight about how they do their protocol. They'll have a psychiatrist screen the person, but have an anesthesiologist administer the molecule. So we've got these two extremes and I'm just like getting the data, you know, like from both extremes and keeping myself as clear as possible.
Well, I think that one of the benefits of where we are in this moment right now in such a hyper-connected world is that we actually can more easily look at these different models and see how they're working. And the sort of like the CAP clinics where people are moving in and out really quickly without the integration component, I think that we'll see how that's working. There's these companies that are doing at-home administered ketamine. I think there's some major problems and concerns with that. But I'm hoping that the best models will rise to the top, especially since ketamine is really, I think, the first step in psychedelic medicine as things get decriminalized and as we're able to onboard psilocybin, group retreats, ayahuasca, which I find to be the most potent form of healing for me. We are getting there, but we have to be vigilant. We must be vigilant.
Ramana Maharishi said, let what comes come, let what goes go, and find out what remains. We're in this big explosion of information. And I try and give everybody a break because we're all in this together. But then there's a part of the boundaries and ethical moral value system when interacting with human beings, you know? So I wonder how that's going to be upheld with the least amount of damage. We just have to see.
Well, and I think we just have to collaborate a lot and really hold each other accountable. And you know, just continue to create platforms and content and voices, because I think where everyone really is in this for healing, mm-hmm. there's also a profit motive that's present as well in people's lives. It's the nature of our capitalist economy, but people really are in this for healing. So the more we can share our best practices, the more we can create coalitions of best practices where people want to be a part of those coalitions, I think the more likely we are going to be to heal the most people with the least amount of damage mm-hmm. as we learn how best to support people with these molecules and these experiences.
Yeah. Communication. Yeah. Holding each other accountable. We're all in relationship to this medicine, amen. It's pretty amazing.
It's absolutely paradigm shifting. And, you know, you're talking about relationships and connection and a social model of healing. And we need to heal our society as well. And part of healing our society is in this style of collaboration and growth as well as practitioners, healers, and advocates.
It definitely. It feels good to talk like this. It feels really good. Thank you.
Oh, I'm so happy. I love talking like this. That's why it's my job.
It's wonderful.
Well, Priya, it's been such a pleasure to get to know you. And I really feel your heart in this work. Like, it's so obvious in speaking to you how much heart you bring to the table and how much of a love and beloved energy flows through you in the work you do. So it's a real honor to speak with you. And I'm really grateful for myself and on behalf of our audience here for everything that you've shared.
Oh gosh, Eamon, thank you. Thank you so much for having this and lighting the way and being here.
And Priya, how can people connect with you? People listening to you today, if they'd like to follow up, where can people find out about your work? Maybe even if you're taking on patients, where can people follow you?
Maybe my website, www.stateofmindwellness.center.
We'll have that in the show notes. So,
thanks. Thank you.
Well, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you. And thank you so much for everything you do.
Oh, the pleasure is mine. Thank you. It's really an honor. It's a joy.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.